Good evening. It's late, and I'm just going to have to put a disclaimer on this one. I just feel like reading, and I haven't really looked at the book for however long it's been, and I'm sure that I'll mess up on the words tonight, because I'm sort of tired, and this book is already hard to read anyway, sometimes with the different pronunciations, but I'm going to give it a whirl. It's January. What is tonight? 16. 16? Wow. Here's the first chapter of, or not the first chapter, the next chapter of The Lady in Gold, The Extraordinary Tale of Gustav Klimt's Masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Blockbauer by Anne Marie O'Connor. The Castle of the First Reichsmarschall. By 1943, Baroness Elizabeth Bakofenecht, one of the dispossessed heirs of the Lederer Klimt collection, was living in desolate isolation. Beautiful Liesel spent her days in virtual solitary confinement. As the hours passed, did she sometimes wonder if she was losing her mind? The Lederer Klimt collection had been seized and sent to Schloss Immendorf. Her mother was eking out a bleak existence in Budapest. Elizabeth was apparently still living at Jokingas, though the home was in the name of her Aryan ex-husband, Wolfgang. Reinsch said Wolfgang worried about her, even took her to see her mother in Budapest before Serena died there in March. Wolfgang was also listed as the seller of two Lederer Klimts, the faculty paintings, philosophy, and jurisprudence to the Belvedere. Thanks to the Nazis, Klimt's shocking modernism was finally making its way into the academy. Okay, I'm going to give a little aside here because I just came across this word that has been bothering me for a week now, at least a week on Twitter. Ever since the thing we had in the Capitol here in the United States, the Twitter frenzy, I'll call it, is awash with people calling those of us that are fighting for freedom of speech and things like that, we're being called Nazis. And I think it just hit me that when I read this word here tonight, that I've been reading about the Nazi regime and how shitty they were. Excuse the expression. Oh, that's not really a great term for it, but it's the simplest term. And to hear these folks throw that term around over and over and over to people that are fighting for freedom of speech for the left, not just the right, but the left as well, and anyone else in between and around. Okay, that's my little rant. Anyway, it just hit me tonight why that word has triggered me on another platform is because of me reading this book. I'll have to process that a bit. Okay, back to the text. Here we go. Where are we? Okay, we just said that Wolfgang had done this jurisprudence. Thanks to the Nazis, Klimt's shocking modernism was finally making its way into the academy. Loneliness was Elizabeth's first waking sensation. She flipped through her books at Jokingas or watched the noisy construction crews that were excavating the garden of the Belvedere outside her window, pouring heavy concrete into an immense underground chamber under the pound. Gross. Sorry. Now it's going to really bug me. Her neighbor A little boy named Hans Holing watched the goings-on with interest. He would grow up to become one of Austria's finest architects. The composer Richard Strauss, living nearby with his Jewish daughter-in-law under the protection of Baldur von Schirach, had to walk around the construction site as he strolled the Belvedere Gardens. There would have been few other witnesses to the mysterious project at the Belvedere except the leonine stone sphinxes, the guardians of secrets. The brilliant former director of the Austrian Gallery, Franz Martin Halberditzel, was very ill in January 1944 from the complications of his degenerative disease. He spent the last hours of his life in a chilly apartment at the Belvedere, listening to his daughter Magdalene read the work of the Austrian poet Rainier Maria Rilke, a fellow soul seeker whose lover had been a disciple of Freud. "Think, dear friend," Rilke had written, "reflect on the world you carry within yourself." Halberditzel sifted through a lifetime of memories. He had attained the dream of Austrian art he shared with Adele, at least for a fleeting instant. Now, as a bitter winter wind blew across the snowdrifts outside, Magdalene read from the notebooks of Malte Lorid's Brig, a story about the meaning of time as death draws near. "You come and keep what is monstrous behind you, as if you had come far in advance of everything that may come, and had at your back only your hastening here, your eternal path, the flight of your love." Magdalene's voice grew fainter as Halberditzel, the gentle visionary, closed his eyes and slipped away from his ravaged world forever. The Austrian gallery's paintings had been carted away to castles throughout Austria. Other works went to the ancient Celtic salt mines deep in the bowels of the earth at Alt Asse, where they were packed like furniture next to art from all over Europe. By September 1944, as Goebbels waged totaler Kriegensatz, or total war, the museum was closed. In reality, the Austrian gallery had ceased to function solely as a museum. Now it was also occupied with the administration and protection of stolen art. There had been a Nazi plan for a museum of Prince Eugene's military exploits, but there was no time for that. The massive fortified bunker under the Belvedere was completed and a military team moved in. As Allied air raids began, a metal periscope emerged from the ground above the bunker and sounded an alarm. Baldur von Schirach had alternate offices in the Belvedere, and as bombing intensified, these elegant digs became much more attractive. Schirach had a deadly fear of bombings and a love of bunkers, and this new refuge was designed to be impregnable. A National Socialist daily called the Belvedere the castle of the first Reichsmarschall. Prince Eugene's Belvedere had become a true palace of war. As the days grew shorter in the autumn of 1944, perhaps the comings and goings at Belvedere relieved the endless monotony of Elizabeth's days at Jachengass. What was left for her? Her mother had not lived to see the Jewish citizens of Budapest deported to Auschwitz. Her mother's sister, Aranka Munk, had been expelled from her Austrian country villa at Bad Aussee. Now just a few miles from the vacation homes of Nazi leaders at Alt Aussee. Aronka had been arrested in October 1941. By then, deportees were driven away in open-air trucks while Viennese on the streets yelled obscenities and catcalls. Onlookers laughed at old people who couldn't walk, who had to be lifted into the deportation trucks in chairs. Jeering crowds was the last sight of their beloved Vienna. Aronka died a few weeks later in Lodz, Poland. Her daughter was murdered at the Chelmno camp in 1942. Someone carted away the painting Klimt had done of Aronka's daughter Ria after her death, in which the fading Klimt had struggled to infuse his subject with life. The man Ria had killed herself for, Hans Heinz Ewers, the German writer of popular vampire novels, was by then penniless and dying of tuberculosis following a Nazi flirtation that had not ended well. He earned the Führer's approval with a biography of a Nazi martyr, Horst Wessel, a young brown shirt who had been shot by the supposedly communist pimp of his prostitute girlfriend and was nonsensically celebrated as a Nazi everyman. But the writer found himself banned when he'd created a valiant Jewish mistress in his novel Vampire. The revelations of his support for a homosexual literary magazine sealed his exile. Amelie Zuckerkandel, the white-shouldered model for the unfinished Klimt masterpiece, whose father had written a play with Mark Twain, had been deported in 1943 with her daughter, Nora Steinsne. They were believed to have died in Belzec. Authorities had also deported Samuel Morgenstern, the Jewish gentleman who had taken pity on the down-and-out young Hitler and bought his mediocre Vienna paintings. Morgenstern wrote Hitler a desperate letter. There was no reply. Morgenstern, 68, died of exhaustion in the Lodz ghetto in August 1943. His widow probably died in Auschwitz. In this bleak Vienna, there was almost no one left In this bleak Vienna, there was almost no one left who had not betrayed the decency of Elisabeth Bakofenecht. She made a final foray to the Bakofenecht Schloss in Neusdorf, the home of her brother-in-law, Eberhard, and the seat of the beer fortune Elizabeth's father had bailed out. She walked into the great house. The servants knew Elizabeth well. They were shocked to see her. They stared at her as if she were a ghost, but they made no effort to stop her as she made her way to the nursery of her nephew, Eberhard's son. He was a little boy, his age close to that of Elizabeth's son, August, when he died. Trying not to cry, Elizabeth told her small nephew that she loved him very much, but these were very hard times and they would not see each other for a long while. She stooped down to hug him and kissed him goodbye. Eberhard was furious when he found out. Relations like Elizabeth were hardly an asset for someone in the SS. By October 1944, air raids were taking a toll on Vienna. As fierce battles raged, turning the tide of World War II, the forsaken Elizabeth succumbed to deep depression until finally, Gustav Reinsch wrote, "She died of a broken heart. Another piece of Klimt's painted mosaic had crumbled." The next piece is called The Partisans. At the Zagreb prison, Nellie, as 15, was becoming a young woman. She angled for the chore of emptying the chamber bucket because it was the social event of the day where prisoners chatted and got to know each other. Some partisans befriended her and asked her to help them. Nellie got permission to see a dentist. A prison guard had to accompany her, and since Nellie had promised him a mushroom omelet, he looked forward to it. The dentist belonged to the Communist Party. Once in his chair, Nellie took off her shoes and stockings and handed him the letters hidden there, important partisan mail, messages to prisoners' families, and letters from her parents to family members. Nellie asked to stop down the street at a tiny store where an old lady sold buttons. There she delivered more letters while the guard smoked outside. Nellie returned to prison with correspondence passed along by the dentist and the button lady. Authorities eventually arrested the dentist and sent him to a concentration camp, but he never implicated Nellie or the buttons lady. Nellie had reached the age when she wondered if boys found her pretty. Nellie did not possess Louise's soft baby face. The solitude of her childhood had not encouraged her to cultivate the teasing banter or the sultry gaze with which Louise had entranced young men in Vienna. Physically, Nellie took after her father, her face lean, her cheekbones high, but she had none of his easy confidence. Nellie was reserved and wary, with watchful eyes. Still, Nellie had admirers, among them the Croatian former policeman imprisoned for his letter of outrage at Jasenovac. One day at sunset, he led the prisoners in a courtyard serenade of Nellie. She smiled down from the window of her cell, thrilled. Perhaps the Croatian policeman had learned Nellie was Jewish. Jewish women were fair game, lucky to be alive. The Croatian no longer felt obligated to court Nellie or win her heart. One day, while cooking greens on a table, throwing bits to the ducks that quacked noisily for scraps at her feet, Nellie heard footsteps. Before she could turn around, someone grabbed her in a tight embrace. It was the Croatian. He was strong. He shoved her against the table, running her hands over her body. Nellie, clutching her knife in her hand, warned him that if he didn't stop, she would cut him. He ignored her. Nellie raised the long knife and brought it down on his hand, yelping in surprise and pain, the Croatian scurried away, clutching his bleeding hand. Nellie proudly told her parents that she had defended her virginity. They exchanged worried glances. Jewish girls did not stab Gentiles with knives. But days went by and nothing happened. The Croatian wore a thick bandage wrapped around his hand. He no longer met Nellie's eyes, but he had not told how he was injured. If he had, he might have doomed Nellie's whole family. Then, one day, the family was sent to live in a sanatorium, and the restrictions on them eased. Louise sent Nellie to live with a woman who hid Jewish children, but then she brought her back, and Nellie later heard the woman was deported to a concentration camp. Then the family was allowed to live in an apartment under the supervision of police detectives, who kept an eye on them when Nellie's father was ordered on trips. Her father told her little about his trips to Hungary and Switzerland. Victor knew what would happen to his family if he used the trips as a chance to escape. In the woods, the partisans drew closer. And that's where I'll stop tonight. Wow, this story is hard to read, but I'm glad I'm reading it and glad I'm finishing it. And we're almost to the end, so hang in there. I'm hoping that, I don't know how it will end, but it's quite the time in our history, isn't it? Okay, thanks again for listening. I'll talk to you soon.